Welcome. Good morning. Welcome to Wake Up America. Thank you all for being here with us. I'm Tina Volpe. I'm your host, and I'm also the author of The Fast Food Craze. I am going to give you a number that if you have any questions or suggestions, you can call in, and it's the number's 800-773-0355. And on this show, we're going to talk about how to eat for life and how to avoid and even cure serious diseases by diet alone, how to embrace the compassion that is living inside each and every one of us, and how to find the love in our hearts for every living creature. We're going to talk about what real food is and how most people don't even realize what it is that they're putting into their bodies, and it's doing such harm. And, of course, the reason that I'm here and the reason that I wrote the book and the reason that I get up every morning is the animals in the factory farms and the slaughterhouses, these precious animals that are living in barbaric conditions, and what we can all do together to help them. We're here to raise awareness and awakeness. So, and I wanted to introduce our incredible guest today. His name is Dr. Will Tuttle. He's the author of The World Peace Diet, and he has a master's degree in humanities from San Francisco State University and a PhD in the philosophy of education from the University of California in Berkeley. He's a professional pianist, a composer, and a teacher. And he has, for the last 15 years, presented at progressive churches, vegetarian and human potential conferences, and intentional communities throughout the country. He trained in Korea as a Zen Buddhist monk and has worked extensively in Tai Chi, yoga, meditation, intuition development, and spiritual healing. He lives in Harrodsburg, California, and welcome, Will. What a lineup, what a background you have.
Wow, it's great to be with you on this program, Tina, and to be able to talk about these important issues.
It is. They are important, too, aren't they? It's why I call this show Wake Up.
It's right.
A wake-up call.
A great title.
It is. And, you know, I listened to your CD last night, and I've been reading your book, and I've got to say, this is so, you're so impressive because of the way that you present things. And to me, it's a very loving presentation, and that is what makes people become more willing to listen, because we're not chastising. You're showing love, and you're showing compassion, and you're showing, you know, the good stuff, the good stuff. and your food, you know, and your presentation is incredible. But I have a bunch of questions for you.
Okay.
The first one being our food choices. You know, people don't connect with our food choices being compassionate towards other humans and compassionate towards living creatures and our attitudes and what our food choices do to our relationships. And I kind of wanted you to elaborate a little bit on that because you showed so much on this CD. I was really impressed with it.
Right. Well, you know, we say food choices, and they are choices, actually, as long as we're adults. You know, we make choices about our food. And the irony of it, though, I think, is that they're not choices that we make freely, typically, for most of us, because most of us are still living under the thrall, really, of our culture. And we were all forced as children to eat foods that were given to us by our parents and by our culture, and that we're taught that's how you normally eat. You know, that's the food that you, as an American, for example, this is what we eat here. And so it's, to me, it's very humorous in a sense when if I'm talking to someone and I'm encouraging them to not eat animal foods, to eat a more plant-based diet, and there's this sense of them saying, well, don't tell me what to eat. You know, I'm going to make my own choices on this. And in fact, people are being told what to eat all the time. They've been told ever since they were born what to eat, and we're still absolutely barraged with a deluge of propaganda from the meat, dairy, and egg industry and from the medical industry that are telling us what to eat. And those sources of information are all part of what I call the herding culture that we live in, which is a culture that basically is oriented at its very core around seeing animals as mere commodities to be used and eaten. and you know, killed. And so I think that people don't actually make choices for food very often. Very often they're eating what they unconsciously were programmed to eat, and they disconnect actually from the implications of this. And this disconnectedness is a habit that we are, again, trained in from a very young age. And it really does, like you said, Tony, it really, Dina, it really does affect our relationships enormously, our relationships with ourselves starting out, because it numbs us.
Right, and because we are going, it's almost like we're half asleep and numb in that area, in that compassionate area, because we're ignoring what is actually going into our bodies because we're not acknowledging. We're not acknowledging that there was pain caused. It has an influence on how we are interact with other people and our compassion level. I think
that's one of the real main core points that I make in the World Peace Diet, you know, my new book, is that the mentality that is at the very core of our culture is invisible to us, because it's like water is to a fish. We're just in it. You know, no one ever talks about it. I mean, we have a word for someone who looks at animals as living beings who shouldn't be eaten and have compassion for them. That word is veganism. And you can say, oh, yeah, I'm a vegan. But there's not even a word for someone who looks at animals as mere food objects and commodities. You know, we don't have a word for that, because it's just how everybody sees it, so we never needed a word for it. One woman, I think, proposed that this new word, carnism, being a carnist. But, you know, the idea is that we don't even have a word. So it's just very deeply impregnated in us by our parents, it was impregnated in them very deeply by their parents, and by their parents, and by their parents. So this kind of goes back about 8,000 years or so when it first started in. And it really does, I think you're right, just disconnect us from the natural compassion that we feel. None of us wants to see others suffer, and none of us, I don't think, wants to, at least in our true heart, wants to actually, you know, cause suffering directly to other beings, especially those that are vulnerable in our hands, that never hurt us, that are no threat to us, you know, cows and pigs and chickens and turkeys and such. They're so defenseless, and they're so non-threatening, and we know they just want to be able to live their lives. But we are, pretty much all of us are part of a system. We're born into a system, and we become actually the agents of that system. And since we're the agents of the system of horrific cruelty to other beings, and we can't bear to think of that, then we basically just become very good at disconnecting from the results of our actions. And that is, I think, a huge unhealthy situation.
Well, what's amazing, too, about this whole situation is that it's so hidden from us, like you talked about on your CD and in the book, The World Peace Diet. It's so hidden from us because we go into the grocery store, we see these little packages, and like you said, if you were to go up to the checker and that checker were to go to the back and pick up a chicken and cut its head off right in front of us, we would not be able to partake. And that's what the biggest problem is I see, is that, you know, there's so many people that I talk to that don't have a clue what goes on in factory farms or slaughterhouses. They picture what they show us on television.
Right.
You know, they picture these beautiful grazing pastures and these animals out there living their life wonderfully. It just boggles my mind that how hidden it is. And that's my thing, is that I think that people, once they know and once they start to see what is really going on, that more and more people will wake up and say, wait a minute, this is
right.
We do have that compassion, even though we've numbed it, even though we've chosen to eat animals and chosen to live the life that we're living from our parents and from whatever else. I think that it's still there. It just needs to be awakened.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. And it was interesting because I just yesterday was talking to an old friend of mine, and she was saying how she never really questioned eating meat or eating animal, you know, flesh. And at one point when she was driving to work, she had to go by this certain place here. It was in Sonoma County, California, and it was actually a small chicken slaughtering plant. And she could see them bringing the chickens in day after day, and it started making her think. And eventually, she just realized that she didn't want to be part of it. She could kind of see it, you know, the suffering that was behind those walls, even though she didn't go back behind there. But she could see the trucks coming in, and she could see evidence of them being very afraid. And of course, that exposure, just that little bit of exposure, got her thinking, got her to stop eating animal foods. But now she said, you can't see any of that anymore. They put up walls so that the trucks are invisible. Everything is unseen, you know. And I think the industry knows very, very well that, you know, if people knew, you know, just even 1 or 2% of this amount of cruelty and suffering that's involved in factory farming, slaughterhouses and warehouses for animals, and feedlots and all these things, that they would be very uncomfortable with it. And so it's kept not only hidden, but I think it's just the reverse. There's, McDonald's saying that burgers come from a burger patch, you know, that kind of idea that they, you know, these burgers just sort of are given to us by trees. They just sort of fall into our hands like apples do. And the little kids get this idea because as a little child, I don't know where, you know, my mother told me I have to eat some liver and I'm going to have we're going to have hot dogs or, you know, or fish sticks. I really didn't know what they were. I mean, I thought they were, oh, okay, that's kind of like an apple, an orange, a fish stick, a drumstick. I mean, it's all kind of, you know, who knows? It's all very mysterious when you're a little kid at a certain age. And then at one point, we find out gradually, usually, and by then we've been desensitized, and it's too late to change. And for most of us, it just affects our psychology and I think our spirit in a very negative way. And I don't think we can really ever hope. That's why I call it the World Peace Diet. I don't think we can ever hope for peace on this planet among humans as long as we have in the background this raging fury of violence that's going on. You know, actually, every hour in the United States alone, there are around 2 to 3 million animals killed. You know, that's incredible to think of that volume. 2 to 3 animals are being killed totally unnecessarily for food. And it's hard to even imagine that. I mean, it's one way to picture it is 1 million, it would be if you had a football length field and animals and 300 animals, you know, lined up. In other words, one animal every foot along that line, say, of chickens and turkeys and cows and pigs, and that line would be whizzing by, you know, every second. I mean, 300 animals every second is what our slaughterhouses are killing, and most of those animals all of them have been very badly treated, and they're in terror. And so for us to eat all that, too, so
the energy,
yeah, it's all hidden. Like you say, it's all hidden.
Yeah, but the energy that comes from that, too, I mean, all that anguish and everything is in the meat, and not to mention everything else, all the chemicals
right.
and all the, and that going into our bodies has to somehow desensitize us, and it also has to somehow crush our spirituality somehow. I don't see how anyone could be truly spiritual and allow and watch this kind of violence.
Right.
And,
well,
you know,
that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah, and you mentioned the violence against animals and how it creates violence towards each other. And it's all intermingled, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, that's one of the main things I realized in my research, actually, when I looked into this. And I have a chapter in the book called The Nature of Intelligence. And in that chapter, one of the main things I realized as I was writing the chapter as well, sometimes I find that the more contemplate these interconnections and write about them and think about them, the more it all becomes clear. And I realized as I was writing and thinking and contemplating about this this situation that we're born into in our culture, that if you really look at pretty much every dilemma that we face as a species. You know, all the things in the newspapers and on the TV that we're facing, the problem of obesity, for example, or the problem of drug addiction, or the problem of the breakup of the family, or the problem of living in increasingly toxic environment, or the problem of terrorism and war. You see that no matter what you think of, any kind of problem, child abuse, you'll see that everything that we are experiencing that's negative in this way, we are first inflicting directly onto those animals. You know, we are forcing animals to be obese because they're paid. You know, we're paid by the pound. The more obese they are, the more money we make. And we're forcing them to live in toxic environments. We're forcing them to live in families that are, I mean, they don't have any families. We're breaking up their families. There's no family structure at all. The babies are stolen from their mothers always. And we're raping the females. We're terrorizing them. I mean, every single thing, we're torturing them. Everything that we see in our world that we would like to solve, we are actually doing to others. And the ancient traditional wisdom of all the cultures, I think, at the very core, the spiritual wisdom, is this teaching, which is, whatever I would like for myself, I must give to others.
Others, absolutely.
You know what, Will? Yeah, exactly.
I hate to do this, but we need to go to break real quick.
Great.
We'll come back with you guys in a minute and continue this wonderful conversation.
You're listening to Global Talk Radio.
Hi, and welcome back. We're speaking with Dr. Will Tuttle, and we're talking about violence and how it's affecting us with what we're doing to our precious animals on this planet. And I'm sorry, I interrupted you earlier, Will, but we were talking about...
Right, I was just saying how whatever we do to animals tends to boomerang and come right back and hit us, you know. So when we stab them, one of the great ironies that occurred to me, you know, we line animals up in these lines, and we just stab them one after the other because, you know, you never kill an animal. I saw this directly. I was at I attended a slaughter of a cow when I was only 12 years old, and I really saw it directly how you can never kill, you know, sort of kill an animal and then cut it up and so forth. You have to cut the animal up while it's still alive, basically while the heart is beating. Otherwise, the meat will be too soaked with blood, and nobody wants blood-soaked meat. So the animal has to be... stabbed while it's alive, and the major arteries cut. And so that's why the slaughtering process is so hideously cruel, is that very often these animals are conscious while they're being cut apart. And... But this is what we do to animals, you know, one after the other. We're stabbing them, bleeding them out, and then people eat the flesh of these animals, and they're it's so toxic, it's so loaded with saturated fat and cholesterol that we're not equipped biologically to handle that. Our arteries get clogged up, and so we have all these people now, and basically it's an assembly line operation in the major metropolitan hospitals of the United States. They go through many times, like between 50 and 100 people every day. They line them up and stab them, you know, for heart bypass surgeries, and then they go and eat more meat and dairy right afterwards, and the industry is guaranteed return customers. So the meat industry is the largest industry in the world, in the United States. I mean, the food industry is, and that's mainly meat. And the second largest industry is the medical industry. And these two just work together hand in glove, as far as I can tell, in the banks in the background, you know, require a steady stream of sick people to get paid back all the investment, the trillions of dollars of investment in the medical industry and the pharmaceutical industry. And the only way you're going to get that is with a steady stream of sick people. And the only way to guarantee a steady stream of sick people is to feed them lots of animal-based foods. So the cruelty that we mete out to animals eventually always comes back to us. And I've seen so many people suffering really terribly from heart disease and diabetes and cancer and obesity and all these different symptoms, really, of cruelty.
Right. Well, they call that, from what I've understood, and I hate to look at it this way, but they say it's the animal's revenge because, and I know that animals are the most loving creatures on this planet. They have no revenge. They have no...
They don't have an ego for that kind of revenge idea to happen. You're right. Yeah,
right.
It's true.
And it's, but it is. It's from us eating them. It's coming back to to haunt
us. Well, and that's the things that you can see, Tina, those kinds of things. But I think, really, I think the main point in my book, or one of the main points, is that what is less obvious is really the psychological hardening that happens. And I've seen, for example, when I've explored world religions, and I used to teach world religions, actually, at college level, that the traditions within all the world religions, when people are really going for the highest level of realization, you know, the more esoteric parts of the tradition, in the monasteries and the meditation centers and in the places where people really practice spirituality, not just, you know, go maybe once a week and hear the indoctrination, but where the people are really serious, they typically always eat very little or no animal foods. I mean, there's been a realization, I think, Pythagoras and the ancient wisdom traditions in Greece, for example, were totally vegan. And I lived in a Zen monastery in Korea that had been vegan for about 600 years. You can imagine, that was quite an experience to be in such a place where, you know, they just for centuries.
And I bet they were the most spiritual people on the planet because they weren't doing harm.
Right. That's seen as a foundation. You can't be, you know, stabbing and killing with one hand and then praying with the other hand.
I wanted to ask you about this. You know, you mentioned the traditional religions of the world and how they were always, in the early days, hundreds or thousands of years ago, there was compassion. Most of them believed that they should not cause suffering to any living being, and now it's been suppressed and it's been hidden and or ignored. And I know that people go to church and they pray and they do all these things, and then they go home and they eat a roast beef.
Right. Yeah, that's true. I was taught in church that the animals were put here for us by God, and that we needed the protein to live, and that was pretty much the end of the story. You know, that He gave them to us, that we were given these animals to eat, and that was their purpose.
Right.
And so I think, like all of us, we just believe what we're told by our culture, whatever our culture tells us. If our culture told us, you know, animals have their own purpose and we're not to eat them, we're to eat vegetarian or vegan way of eating, we'd totally be happy with that. We would never on our own. No, I don't think anyone on his own or her own would ever go out and start killing and stabbing animals if we weren't forced into it at birth.
What I don't understand, and what I'd like your input on, is where did this chain get broken? How come early religion believed it wasn't okay to suffer or to harm animals? Why? I just don't understand how it got from there to loving animals and appreciating animals and not causing any suffering to where we are now. Where did that chain break? Is it because we just ignored it or what?
Yeah, well, I think when people, it wasn't just people in general, but there was a certain part of the world primarily, which was in what's called the Levant area of the Eastern Mediterranean, what is today actually where, ironic, where there's so much in what we call the Middle East, Iraq and or Israel and so forth, people began to herd animals, and they are large animals, and that caused a whole different mentality to emerge. And those people, they began to see animals as capital, as property, and a culture emerged where there was a wealthy elite, and then they owned the most cattle, and they needed a religion that would support their practice. And these people became the most warlike, the most cruel, the most hard-hearted, especially the men. And it was the first time when women actually became more as slaves, and actually they began to enslave people too. Huge slave cultures developed in the Middle East back in from the years 10,000 about 10,000 years ago to about, well, you can see it by the time the historic period emerged, which was 4,000 years ago with the first writing, and the earliest books that we have from that time, like the Old Testament and the Epic of Gilgamesh and these ancient writings, you can see a culture that had at its core owning animals, owning people, owning women, and enslaving people, and that the ones who were the rich elite, at the end of the day and at the middle of the day, you know, when they sat down, they ate the flesh of animals. And these people went on gradually to conquer and spread this way of being. They eventually spread over the entire Mediterranean, eventually it spread to Europe, and then eventually from Europe they came here to this, you know, to this hemisphere,
and
just
that belief
kept spreading.
Win.
So,
right.
In a way, from my point of view, it's kind of a spread of violence that we've seen, and it started to just take away the older wisdom, which I think we all know in our culture, the loss of the feminine sensitivity and intuition and spiritual depth, and I think we yearn to reclaim that again. But we're raised in a culture that's comes directly from this old violent herding culture, and they changed their deity, the gods that they, you know, became these violent war gods, and they we still see that today. A lot of people, you know, when we talk, even Christians talk about how, you know, God is on our side when we fight a war and so forth, and these ideas of violence and of religion supporting that violence, I think we have to realize, basically, this is the last thing I'll say about it, is that any culture, no matter what the culture is, will try to reproduce itself. That's what it does. A culture, if it's a culture of violence, it will try to reproduce itself. If it's a culture of compassion, it will try to reproduce itself. And it just does. You know, it just reproduces itself through... And the parents pass on into their children, and you know, what they believe and how they see things. And so any culture wants to reproduce itself, and it will do that through its institutions. And the main institutions are religion, education, government, law, the family. And so the religion, for example, cannot be that much different than the culture, because the culture is using the religion to reinforce and pass on its main values. And so if the culture is oriented around seeing animals as commodities and things to be used and to eat them at the end of the day as a reward for, you know, competing and winning, then the religion that it has, you know, as its religion, has got to support that. It has to. There's no other way it can.
Right.
So
what happens with people like us? How come we step out of the box? I mean, is it because we've evolved, we've come back, or
right.
Incarnated, or what is your
yeah.
opinion of that?
See, it's like, you know, a good way to understand it, I think, is with slavery. You know, in 150 years ago, it was totally legal and accepted to own other human beings. And that was an institution that came through the religion, and it was. There's, if you look at the Bible, I mean, there's all kinds of support for slavery of human beings. And but people, if, you know, we can evolve and we can transform our culture, and I think that's what we yearn to do. We want to evolve to a higher level and to live more authentically and to live more at peace and in harmony. In order to do that, we have to change our culture. So I think we're born into a culture, but we can definitely rise to a higher level of ethics and morality and understanding than the one that's propagated by our culture. And that's the only way the culture can advance or and improve and become more wise and harmonious, is if people like us, for example, we have a sense of the animals not as just things to be used, but as beings. And as we begin to talk about this and share and communicate and so forth, we are actually working through the institutions. I go pretty much every Sunday to a church somewhere and talk about this. That's what I do, you know, is I lecture at churches. And so I'm continually confronting this. And so I'm working through the existing institutions in order to change the culture. So it's possible to work through the institutions. Like right now we're talking on, you know, on the radio. So we're working through the media of our culture, and we're giving a different view. And that's, I think, the greatest blessing we can be to our loved ones and to our culture and to everyone, is to work through the institutions to change, to transform the culture.
Right, and step by step. And just like you said, slavery. Look what happened with slavery. That is abolished. That's gone.
Right.
And
exactly.
This is,
we see, you know, how, yeah, we look back and we go, oh, what a terrible time that was when people, you know, when you own people, you can kill them, you can rape them, you can do whatever you want to them, and nobody questions it because they're just property.
Right.
And we think how terrible for those people to have to live, not only for the slaves, of course, but even the slave owners. You know, we can see how it was just a dark time for everybody, actually. And I think
what I'm wondering too is, do you see this in our lifetime? Do you think that in our lifetime we are going to see a major change and a major shift in the way these animals, just the way slavery?
Yeah, I think we will, actually, because the system that we're living in cannot continue. It will degenerate into more and more violence. Unless we have a major change. So in one way or the other, it will change, either sort of voluntarily by people awakening, by us communicating, and by people making more conscious choices and beginning to embody the truth that we are, which is peace and love and compassion in our relations with others, or we will continue to act in ways that reflect the violence of our culture, which, as I say in my book, is diminished intelligence. I mean, the intelligence is just the ability to make connections. And so, you know, living in a culture where we see animals as commodities, we've learned, we become masters, we practice every day the art of disconnecting. And so we're so good at disconnecting. We can disconnect from anything, you know, just we practice. It's like, you know, practicing baseball. If someone just throws pitches anywhere and I get really good, I can hit anything. Whatever the guy, pitches, I can hit it. We've gotten to the point where no matter what happens, whatever anyone says, you know, we can disconnect from it. We can just disconnect. People are starving, I can disconnect from that. We're killing people in Iraq, I can disconnect from that. We're slaughtering animals, I can disconnect from that. And we become just incredibly skillful at disconnecting.
Right.
And that's a loss of intelligence, and that, so the Earth is going to be speaking to us, you know, more and more strongly with global warming
and with avian flu and everything, we've got
all these things. And
we're going to go to break real quick.
Take a break. Okay.
And then we're going to come back and finish this conversation.
Okay.
come back with us, you guys.
You're listening to Global Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome back to Wake Up America. We're talking with Dr. Will Tuttle, and we were speaking about the change in us as humans evolving And we started to touch on the avian flu, which is my opinion, Will, of maybe it's a wake-up call. Maybe that's what it's going to take. And it's sad because a lot of people are going to die from it.
Well, I think, right, I think the avian flu and mad cow disease, and I think AIDS probably, if you look carefully, and probably a lot of other other diseases. I think a lot of psychological diseases, a lot of stress, a lot of nightmares, there's so many diseases that can be traced to our confinement and killing of animals for food. I would say pretty much all of them, actually, if you look carefully. And so this is what I was just saying earlier, is that intelligence is the ability to respond to feedback, whether it's my intelligence, the intelligence of my culture, the intelligence of a dolphin or a cow or a pig, any animal, any being, any system. Its intelligence is its ability to respond to feedback, and so if we learn to numb the feedback that we're getting, then we will become increasingly out of harmony with who we are and with the larger orders, and the larger orders will let us know. So the Earth and so forth, the larger systems will let us know that we must come back into harmony. That's why I think that in our lifetime we will see the end of animal agriculture in some way or another. Either we'll consciously stop it or we will be creating so much violence and stress that it will end in some other way. But I think it will end.
If I can see that in my lifetime, I will get on my knees and thank the universe, because I think we will. And, you were talking about intelligence, and this is what really amazes me, is that people, I hear it all the time, oh, it's just a stupid chicken, or oh, it's just a dumb turkey. I'm not kidding. I have chickens and turkeys. These animals are incredibly intelligent, and I wanted to go into that a little bit because, everything is based on our human intelligence, and animals have their own intelligence, and I kind of wanted you to elaborate on that a little bit about our intelligence in animals.
I think, like I said earlier, the intelligence of any being or of any organized system, like a culture, has its own intelligence, too. The Earth has its own intelligence. The universe, I think, has an intelligence. For example, a chicken has a vast intelligence, and I think to the degree that I honor and respect my own intelligence and try to protect it, I will see that in others. I will see the intelligence of a chicken, for example, as enormous. I mean, think of the incredible amount of intelligence invested in a chicken by the universe. That this is a being that has tremendous capacities, not only to heal, to live, to mate, to raise the young, to protect the young, but also contributes to the intelligence of the ecosystem that she's a part of. And chickens evolved for millions and millions of years in Southeast Asia, and they were part of the ongoing celebration of life in the jungles. And you can just imagine being there and just how them crowing in the morning and raising young and being part of the celebration of life. I think if we stop eating animal foods, we begin finally to really look out of our eyes and look out at the universe and at the Earth, and we see beauty, we see celebration, we see intelligence, we see a whole interactive unfoldment on this Earth that is so incredibly beautiful. And we see the preciousness and the sacredness of all beings, the birds, the fish, the animals are all part of this, and we're part of it. And there's this yearning to protect and care for and enjoy life. And to the degree, though, that my intelligence has been repressed by eating animal foods, and I look out and see a world of competition and a world where beings don't really matter and everything is looked at as sort of, as we're taught in college, as a cost-benefit analysis, what's the economic value of this forest? How many board feet of timber can you get out of it? How much money can you make from these animals? That kind of mentality just reduces everything, and that reducing of nature and of animals, what so-called animals, That actually reduces me. That reduces my mind. I become reduced, and we live in a very reduced world. We have a reductionist science and a reductionist religion. We have a science that just reduces beings to mere biological, chemical, genetic organisms that, you know, that just are totally only care about themselves. And we have a religion that reduces the infinite beauty and mystery to this sort of hierarchical male deity that's dominating the world. These are just absurdities that are propagated by our culture, because our culture, again, has disconnected from its intelligence, because every day, you know, day in and day out, we're eating reduced animals.
Right.
And we're reducing the world. And so intelligence is the opposite of that. And I think if I really see a chicken, for example, or a fish, or any animal that is seen merely as food, with eyes that are intelligent and awake, then I can't help but just be amazed at the beauty and the sense of purpose. These beings have a purpose. And it was the same thing with black people in 1830 in Georgia, for example. You know, if you did something to a black person, killed them or whatever, people would say the same thing. Oh, it's just, you know, they don't matter. They don't have a soul. You know, they don't have a soul. Who cares about them? They're just, you know, they're just put here for us to use. So we can do that. We're doing that to our enemies, you know, in Iraq. We don't even count how many we kill. We just kill them because they're like, they're just, you know, they're just...
Sorry,
so this act of reducing, it hurts us. The ancient teachings say that when I harm another, I harm myself more than I harm them, because this harming of my spirit, it's really a spiritual. Numbing and damage that we do to ourselves, and it's probably the worst thing that we can do to ourselves is to hurt others.
And you're right. It's like the person that's causing the harm is doing more damage because they're actually numbing themselves even further.
Right, and that's why, you know, sometimes people look up and they think, oh, if I could only, you know, be rich and have lots of money and live like the wealthy elite lives. And if you look carefully at the lives of the wealthy elite, you'll see suicide, drug addiction, misery. I mean, people, just because you have a lot of money, I'll tell you, it does not make happiness
money
at all.
Money does not do anything except provide for you. What really is
right.
going to make your life better is to open and to find that compassion. Like you said, I can go outside and I have baby chickens that crawl on me. Well, they love me so much. They crawl on me and they want
right.
to be loved. And
right.
that's when you start to feel the joy and the love inside on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
You
right.
can't feel that until you embrace that compassion that we've lost
right.
because we're numb.
Right.
And I know exactly what you're saying. And that whole thing about causing harm and being harmed further yourself is so evident to me now. And I just wish
right.
that we could, if you were to go into, okay, if you were to talk to some of these religious leaders, say,
mm-hmm.
I don't even want to come up with a name, but how can we reach them? Is there something that we should be doing to reach them, to teach compassion for all living creatures instead of just each other?
I really think, Tina, that you're onto something with that. I think our religious leaders are not at all sensitized to this issue like they should be.
No.
And if we want to create a context, a new context of compassion on this planet, then we it's really important to talk to them in terms they can understand. And I think point out, you know, Jesus was more than anything talking about compassion for those who are vulnerable. That was his essential message. For anyone who's a Christian in this country, and most of the people, you know, see themselves that way. So I think that's an extremely important point to emphasize, and to just look at the teachings of Jesus and feel into what they're saying. And that's what I try to do. But I think the most important thing is for me to live this totally, and then my words will carry weight. As Gandhi said, I have to be the change I want to see in the world. So if I have a lot of anger inside me and so forth, and come across to people with anger and I'm depressed and miserable about what's happening to animals, it's going to be hard. They're not going to listen to me. So I think it's really important for us who are vegans and who are caring or who really care about animals and want to make a better world for all of us, animals and humans, to root out of ourselves the seeds that have been planted in us of exclusivism. Because the key is, I think, right. that this may be my final thing I can probably say, is that the only way that we can do to animals what we're doing to them is to exclude them from the sphere of our compassion. And so if I, as someone who wants to promote kindness on this planet and compassion for animals, if I ever engage in exclusivism towards other humans, like if I say all those terrible people, I've heard people say, you know, all those scumbags that are killing animals and they're, you know, they're these idiots that are doing this, all that. That's all language and thinking of exclusion. I'm excluding them from my compassion. We have to understand that everyone has a story. All of us have been wounded. In some way by our culture and upbringing, and the only way we can bring healing to this world is to embrace everyone and to include everyone. We have to understand that, I think, at a deep level.
The interconnectedness. We're all
connected. Yes, we're all connected, and our welfare is all connected. The welfare of everyone is connected, so we'll never get happy and joy and peace in our life as long as we're harming others in any way.
Because the connection, it's harm you, harm me. And it's true,
right.
because you have to treat each human being as your brother or sister, as someone who is sharing this life and
right.
that
right.
you're connected to. And you're right about that. And that's why I want so badly to reach these churches, because I believe
yeah.
that they have the right thing. They have the right mentality. They're trying to do better.
Right.
But they're
I
just not
right.
seeing this part of it.
Yeah, well, that's it. And I think maybe, you know, that chapter I have called on Science and Religion in the book has,
right.
I'm hoping that has some of the keys in there to reach these people.
I'm hoping, because I would love to be able to, you've got the credibility, though, Will. I've got some credibility, but to be able to go speak at churches would be my dream, because
yeah.
I would love to be able to reach, because if you think about it, what's the percentage in our United States of religion? Most of these people are church-going religious people, the Christians.
Right, right.
So
I think it's something like 70% of the people think of themselves as, you know, Christians.
Right, and I don't know why, but it's such a big thing to me, because there is such a start there. There's such a good start
yeah.
there, and it's a really good place to start, but I would love to know how to reach them. And I think that you're doing that by speaking in the churches and what you're doing every week.
Right, I try to. I go to primarily to progressive churches, and I think because that's where I feel like at least the people are open to this. But I think it would be good if people went into the more mainstream and fundamentalist churches also, you know. And there hasn't been that many people doing that, but it is starting to happen slowly.
Well, I'm hoping. Well, you know, Pope John Paul, it's in the fast food craze, where he actually spoke
right.
up for animal cruelty.
Yeah.
The newest one.
Yeah.
I forget his name now.
Right. He was Cardinal Ratzinger, but yeah.
Right.
The novel Pope. Right.
Right.
Yeah,
that
I know. That's really true. And if you look, I have in my book quite a few quotes from saints and, you know, religious people from the Christian tradition and all the traditions, and they all uniformly, they all say the same thing, that spirituality, you know, the essential part of spirituality is awakening compassion. And that means kindness to animals. John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, is a great example. He talked about how when Jesus Christ comes into our heart, then we naturally want to protect all the birds and all the fish and the whole creation. You know, and these, so we have these things, and it's just a matter of helping people to get beyond the programming that we're being deluged with. And I think we are making progress, but we have to make more progress.
I think we do, and I think you're right about being what we want to become and just living our lives the way we believe that they should be lived, like loving animals and caring for each other. And when someone needs something, if I see someone on the side of the road, my first instinct is to stop and help them.
Right.
And that's what
I think
I think
all of us have that. I think you give people half a chance, they just love to to help each other. We love helping each other. We really
right.
do.
And that's
just, you know, we're raised in a competitive culture where we're taught we have to compete. You know, there's not enough to go around, and only the rich can buy the things that make you happy, you know, and this whole consumerism, which I also say in my book, is actually a direct result of seeing animals as commodities, because when we, you know, when we see, when we act in a very shallow materialistic way, in terms of our food, which is what we do, we don't even know what we're eating half the time, then we become, become fixated around consuming, and we have this consumerist culture that's just chewing up the earth and turning the beauty and diversity of this planet into cheap plastic junk and stuff that doesn't make anybody any happier. And animals are the ones that and future generations, you know, those who are vulnerable really pay the price for that. So we are in the midst of a huge crisis, really, in this planet we're all called to question everything at the most deep level.
I agree. And, you know, what amazed me, too, was, you know, Al Gore did that, Inconvenient Truth.
Right.
And you know what really amazed me about that? And I'm wondering if it's political. I hate to go into this, but why did he not bring up factory farming? It's a huge issue, the methane gases and things that come. Why didn't that come into that Inconvenient Truth?
Because he wants it to be successful. He wants to sell a lot of them, you know. And as soon as you bring this up, people,
right.
You know, 95% of the people are eating animal foods, you know, pretty much every day. You're going to lose 95% of the people. They're going to be,
absolutely,
not lose them, but they're going to be uncomfortable, you know. And I agree. I mean, you know, he's trying, in a sense, to make people uncomfortable. He's trying to awaken us to the plight that we're in. But I think he realizes either consciously or unconsciously that, when you question food, you're questioning at a deep level, and a lot of people aren't ready to go that deep, but I agree with you. We have to. We have to make these connections. We have to, because it's much worse. I mean, it makes a lot more global warming what we're doing to animals than driving big cars around us.
It does, and you know, we have to sign off here in a second.
Okay.
And I wanted to tell everyone, thank you so much for listening, and you can get Will Tuttle's book. It's called The World Peace Diet, and I recommend it to everyone listening and everyone else on this planet, because this book is incredible.
Available on Amazon or at my website, either one. Will Tuttle.
Perfect. And what's your website, Will?
It's just my name, WILLTUTTLE, WillTuttle.com.
WillTuttle.com. You can get his book there and Amazon. It's called The World Peace Diet. And I wanted to tell Will, first of all, thank you so much for being with us. We enjoyed so much talking to you. And and I always end this with a quote, and of course Gandhi was perfect for this. The greatness of a nation and its moral progress can be judged by the way its animals are treated. God bless you all, and have a wonderful rest of the day.